am very happy to be here this evening to speak to you about the teachings of the Buddha. I will begin with the first verse in the Dhammapada. I hope you have heard about the Dhammapada. This is a collection of verses supposed to be coming from the Buddha, the words of the Buddha. And this is a well-known, famous collection of verses. And the first verse in Pali says, Pali, the scriptural language, and supposed to be the language that the Buddha spoke. In Pali it says, Mano Pubbangama Dhamma, Mano Sitta, Mano Maya, Manasa Te Paduttena Bhasativa Karotiva Tatonam Dukkamang Veti Chakkanga Vahato Padam. Now, the important thing in this verse is that the Buddha says that Mano is a very important word here. Mano, I will first use that Pali word because it is very difficult because of the translations that you have been listening to or reading before. Mano refers to the thinking part of what we call the mind. And Mano Pubbangama Dhamma, there the word Dhamma is not just the teaching of the Buddha. Dhamma simply refers to something like the word phenomena. That means whatever is known to the mind is Dhamma. Now when we speak about the senses, we use the words like, say, Chakku and Rupa. Chakku refers to the eye. Rupa is what we have seen. Sota and Sadda. Sota refers to the ear. And what is heard, the sound, is the sadda. Ghana and Gandha. Ghana is the nose. Gandha is what is smelt, the smells. Jivha is the tongue. Rasa is the taste that we experience. Kaya and Pottabha. Kaya is the body and Pottabha is what we touch. So, then we speak of Mano and Dhamma. Mano is the mental process. And Dhamma is what is conceived through the mental process, the process of conception. But the Dhamma is really the experience, what we experience. So Mano Pubbangama Dhamma means the thinking process precedes all experience. That is the meaning of Pubbangama. Pubbangama means precedes. Now, when I begin to put it in that way, I begin to think of other things coming to my mind, which is really, there is a present day, actually, I think he may be dead now, but it was Sartre, Jean Paul Sartre, who was an existentialist philosopher, who said that existence precedes experience. That existence precedes really essence. Now, these people began to use words like that, existence and essence. It's very important to understand those two words, because these Western philosophers have been using terms like that, and sometimes when we begin to read those words, we don't really understand what they mean. It was people like Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. These were the philosophers who began to speak about a thing called existence and essence. And today, if you begin to look in a dictionary of philosophy or something like that, they begin to define these words as existence simply means that a thing exists, and essence means what exists. So that doesn't convey the meaning properly. But the real meaning is, what they really meant was that when we see an object, we think the object exists. That's the problem. We begin to think that something exists. And then people begin to, people like idealistic philosophers like there was a philosopher called Berkeley. He was a bishop, Bishop Berkeley, who pointed out that when we see an object, what we see is simply a mental image. Whatever we see when we open our eyes is not something really there, but it is all a mental image in our mind. And that image is what we see. It's like taking a photograph with a camera. And the photograph that we see is simply something produced inside the camera. So in a similar way, when I open my eyes and look at something and I see something, it is simply a picture in my mind. That is why Berkeley said there is no such thing as matter. There is only the mind. Because what we call matter is simply a mental image. Whether we open our eyes and see something, or even if I touch something, I feel the touch, and what I feel is really, again, a mental image is produced. So that whatever we perceive through the senses is just a mental image. So this is why that other philosopher, Immanuel Kant, who started saying that there are two things. One is what he called the phenomena, and the other is what that is, whatever is there, which we cannot really see. When we open our eyes, what we see is simply a mental image, but still there must be something there which we cannot see. And that thing that we cannot see, he called the noumena. So he spoke of two things called the phenomena and the noumena. So when these philosophers, like people like even Socrates, Plato and Aristotle, they also began to think of these same things. And they started saying that what we see is what they call existence. So the phenomenon they call existence. And what Kant called the noumena is what they call the essence. But the essence cannot be known. What we know is simply the existence. So this is why Sartre started saying that the existence precedes essence. That means it is the phenomena that we directly know. And because we think of something that we see, so we begin to form a concept that there must be something outside there, and that is the essence. So in other words, what they are trying to point out is the only reality is the phenomenon. What is called the noumenon is only a concept made up. There is no reality about it. And the people who began to think like that were called the phenomenologists. It is called phenomenology. Now, the Buddha was actually thinking in a similar way. So when we talk about the teachings of the Buddha, we are talking about phenomena, what we observe through our senses. It is actually a creation of the senses. This is the point. And today, modern psychologists also, if you read a textbook on psychology, you'll see that they are talking about what is called the theory of perception. And if you begin to understand the theory of perception, they are mainly talking about what is perceived. And it is a creation of the mind. There is this story in the sutras where a certain deva, a deva means something like what you call an angel, came to the Buddha and asked a question. The question was, if you travel in space, will you be able to come to the end of the world? That was the question. The Buddha said, no. You can never come to the end of the world by traveling in space. Now, it's very interesting question and the answer, because the scientists, modern scientists like the famous mathematician and physicist. Who is that man? Einstein, yeah. Einstein pointed out that if you travel in space, you come back to the same point. If you go on a straight line, you come back to the same point. And there was a time when there was the eclipse of the sun, and they did an experiment to find out whether that is true. And they found that that was true. They sent a ray of light and somehow it came back to the same point. So, but the Buddha said, without reaching the end of the world, you cannot bring all suffering to an end. It is necessary to reach the end of the world. But to reach the end of the world, you cannot do it by traveling in space. That's what he pointed out. And then he said, the world, the beginning of the world, the end of the world, and the way leading to the end of the world is in this fathom-long body itself, with its perception and conception. So, this Deva who came and asked the question said, well, it's wonderful what you are saying. I know this through my own experience. He said, before I came into this Deva world or heaven, whatever you call it, I was a human being. And I was a yogi. I had developed psychic powers. And with these psychic powers, I had a very... I was able to travel in space at very high speed. It was, I think, the speed of light or something like that, because he gave an analogy to explain what the speed was. He said, it is like a strong man. At that time they had only bows and arrows. They didn't have guns to shoot. So they made use of that as an analogy. He said, if there's a strong man who could shoot an arrow, and the arrow has to pass the shade of a palm tree. So what the arrow has to do is not to pierce the palm tree, but just pass the shade of a palm tree. Now, the shade of a palm tree would be, say, for example, about 1 foot or something like that. If it is 1 foot, he says, what's the time taken for this arrow to pass that 1 foot? It's a fraction of a second. Now, that fraction of a second, supposing there is a huge man who could put 1 foot at one end of the earth and the other foot at the other end of the earth, I'm assuming that the earth is flat, you see. And that means a huge giant. And the speed or the time taken for this man to change the foot from one end to the other end of the earth, that time is the time taken for this, by this arrow to pass that shade of the palm tree, that is 1 foot. So that is in a fraction of a second, that person can cross the earth. Now, if that was the speed, it is faster than the modern planes, so that it should be something like the speed of light. And because they say light can travel about 16 or 17 times round the earth in 1 second. So if that is the speed of light, so it is something like that. So he could travel at that speed in space, and he says he traveled for 100 years. And at the end of the 100 years, he died. And he was born in that Deva world. So this is why he came and asked this question. But when the Buddha said that the world, the beginning of the world, the end of the world, and the way leading to the end of the world is in this fathom-long body itself, with its perception and conception, what it really means that this thinking process itself is creating the whole world. Now sometimes people ask me, who created the world? One day I had to go to a prison to give a talk there to the prisoners. So there was a monk that I knew who was going regularly to talk to the prisoners. So they wanted, he wanted me to come and give a talk to me, the people. So I went with him. And I gave the talk, and at the end of the talk, I said, if you have any questions, you can ask me. And there was a young man. This young man asked the question. He says, who created the world? I said, you created the world. But that other monk thought I gave a wrong answer. And then he started speaking, and he didn't allow me to speak after that. So I just kept quiet and let him. But the point here was that I was trying to start explaining, because if when I say that, then he has to ask me, what do you mean by that? Then I could have explained this. So somehow the important thing is that this has been really understood by modern psychologists, that we are creating everything. And this is the meaning of phenomenology. Phenomenology means simply that we are creating everything in our mind. The creation. Now there is, immediately after the awakening of the Buddha, I don't call it enlightenment. There is a difference between enlightenment and awakening. It's really an awakening from a dream. Because according to the Buddha, we are simply dreaming. We are dreaming of existence here. Existence is a dream. But when we awaken from this dream, then we realize that nothing is really existing. And that is the meaning of nirvana. So the important thing is that modern psychologists are aware of this, but they don't take it too seriously. That whole concept doesn't enter their normal life. Why? There is a reason for this. The reason is that we are all the time influenced by emotions, not by reason. We might reason out and see certain things, but our whole life is based on emotions. So, the emotions become an obstacle to this awakening process. This is the point. Now, this means when we speak of the mind, we have to understand that what we call the mind is not an entity separate from the body. Mind is not an entity separate from the body. The mind is simply the activity of the body. It is really the activity of the brain and the nervous system and the senses. That's all that is. Now, there was this philosopher called Locke in Western philosophy. He was a man from Scotland. He said, there is no such thing as mind. Mind is simply the activity of the body. Like if you have an engine in the car will move only because the engine begins to get activated. The engine just being there is not going to pull the car. It's only when you switch on, the engine begins to work. And that working is the thing that begins to pull the car. When you connect the gears to that, and that connects the wheels to the engine, and then of course the car begins to move. So in other words, it's the activity that begins so close. So in a similar way, the body is like a machine, and it is this activity which is mainly the nervous system, which is in which the brain is included in the nervous system. Brain, the spinal cord, and the nerves, all these things, and the senses. The activity of that is what we call the mind. This is what Locke started saying. There is no such thing as a mind. There is only the body and its activity. In other words, there is no such thing as matter. I mean, mind. There is only matter. Now, there is this other philosopher who is from Ireland, was Berkeley. He was a bishop. He didn't like that idea. So he brought out another argument and said, what is this thing that you talk about as matter? After all, what you call matter is what you perceive through your senses. And the moment you perceive something, what you perceive is only a mental image. And if it is only a mental image, then there is only mind, there is no such thing as matter. That argument also is correct. But the point is, one position excludes the other. If you take Locke's position, there is no such thing as mind. And if you take Berkeley's position, there is no such thing as matter. There is only mind. This is the problem. So another man came up. He was Hume. He was from England. And he said, you are both wrong, but right to some extent. And then he said, one man proved that there is no such thing as mind. The other man proved that there is no such thing as matter. That is the truth. There is no such thing as matter. There is no such thing as mind. The only thing that we can talk about is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. That's all that we can talk about. There is a sutra where the Buddha speaks about this. A Buddha says, this is the all. What is the all? The eye and what is seen. The ear and what is heard. Sound. The nose and what is smelled. The tongue and what is tasted. The body and what is touched. Feel. And the thinking process. And then he says, if there is any person who says, I can talk about something other than those things, he can be questioned and cross-questioned, and ultimately he will not be able to make good his boast. So in other words, the Buddha took that same position that Hume took. And so all these philosophers were puzzled. They couldn't maintain their views because Hume challenged all these philosophers.